Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very much looking forward to this conversation with Lindsay Borgon about her book titled Tree Thieves, Crime and Survival in North America's Woods, just out in 2022 from Little Brown. This is an absolutely fascinating story, as you can probably tell from the title. Lindsay takes us through the underbelly, really, of the illegal timber market, focusing on the West Coast of North America, both in the United States and Canada, helping us understand what is happening? Why do people illegally cut down trees? What do they do with it? What are the communities where this is happening? And kind of what are the more structural forces that have led us to this place? And really takes us inside all of these sort of tricky and interesting conversations. So Lindsay, I'm so thrilled to welcome you to the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Could you start us off by introducing yourself a bit and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Sure. Yeah. So I am a writer and an oral historian. And in 2012, I heard about an 800-year-old cedar tree that had been stolen off the coast of British Columbia. And that's really the case that got me going on this whole story. So I began looking into kind of what it takes to poach a tree. I was really, I didn't grow up in a community with a lot of tall old growth trees, so it was really surprising to me. And over the years, it became more and more complicated and turned into Tree Thieves, the book that came out this year. That's how I came. That's how I came to the story. And during that time, I also was very lucky. I became a National Geographic Explorer, and I was supported by them to do field work in Peru, where I looked at tree poaching in that context as well. And it really unfolded to me as this big global story that was also like deeply local for a lot of people.
I think we're going to get into a bunch of those things that you raised in the interview. But to start off with, we should probably start at the beginning. What Sure. is timber poaching? How does Yeah. it work? Why do we know so little about the scale of it?
Yeah, great question. Timber poaching is stealing trees. In order to be poaching, those trees are often located on conservation land or on privately held land. And it often looks like cutting down a tree in the middle of the night and loading it up into a vehicle and offloading it either to a mill or selling it as firewood doing artisanal crafts with it, I suppose. And it happens all across North America and certainly through Europe. It's actually on the increase through Europe at the moment. It's often done by small groups of people. I think a lot of people think of illegal logging as logging firms, logging companies kind of going over their allotted cut block space or the space that they've been permitted to cut within. But also it happens just individually quite often, you know, one or two people working here or there and taking down where I live, often old growth or ancient trees I think in the UK that they're called ancestral trees. You know, they're really old, and selling them, putting them on the market because they're very old. They're quite valuable.
Fascinating. and can you? I mean, I can understand the whole at night, then given to a mill, therefore chopped up into pieces. Gives us some idea of kind of why it's hard to understand kind of exactly where and how much this is happening. But do we have any sense of scale?
In the North American context, we have some sense, although it hasn't been, the statistics have not been updated in recent years. But so the Forest Service in the United States, their last sort of study into this found that about $100 million worth of wood is poached off of their land every year. More broadly across the entire country, that ups to 1 billion. And that includes from, you know, private logging land, private homesteads, national park land, any sort of conservation land is under that umbrella. In where I live in British Columbia, that number is about 30 million a year. And around the world, it's actually a $147 billion industry, this type of poaching. So it is a huge part of the sort of underground trade in the natural world. It happens, you know, on scales even greater than rhino poaching or elephant poaching. It is massive. In terms of its share of the underground illegal wildlife trade.
Wow, yeah, that really does put it into perspective.
It happens in all sorts of countries and reasons. Like, for instance, right now, due to the energy crisis, Europe, you know, particularly Germany, they've noticed that there's an increase in firewood poaching from their forests. And so it tends to come and go based off of like public and social need and the state of economics and kind of global factors, which is also really, you know, kind of interesting and something we might not always think of.
Well, I think one thing that you raised in your first answer that really came through in the book quite helpfully was that this is both a global issue, but also, as you said, an intensely local one. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the really helpful contributions of the book is to go deep into the localness of it. Because as you explored that for us and kind of took us on this journey, when the book then goes back into the global, you can start to extrapolate and go, I wonder if some of those dynamics might be true in this other instance, right?
Right.
And so I'd similarly like to go into kind of that intense local, which is mainly in the Pacific Northwest in the book, and talk about these factors, right? Because even though it is a local story, economics are a huge part of it.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about kind of the economic conditions in this part of the world, particularly around unemployment and what that has to do with cutting down trees?
Absolutely. So, you know, as with a lot of other communities around the world, the Pacific Northwest in the kind of late 20th, early 21st century was going through a deindustrialization process. So this was a logging region. A lot of particularly rural areas, they were reliant on logging. You know, mills were built outside of cities, and people were working within the forest and living near the forest. And while there was a lot of deforestation happening and overlogging happening at that time, it was also like the economic driver of an entire region. And due to kind of lots of sort of converging issues in the world of policy and kind of globalization and global trade and environmental activism, the end of that sort of intense period of logging work happened in the 1980s and 1990s, and it really left an entire region filled with these towns and these communities that had lost their main sort of support, you know, their main tax base, their main financial foundation, and also their sort of main reason for operation. And you know, there's a lot of identity involved in that, identity issues of, you know, people really identified with the work, and it was work that supported family life. And it really just kind of, it didn't entirely disappear. We have logging here now, but it's nowhere near the scale that it used to be. And the way that this looks now, you know, kind of like trickled down 30 to 40 years later, is that there are a lot of rural areas that are struggling and deep, you know, with deep poverty. And so, you know, there are families that still are really rooted and connected to these regions that don't feel that they can actually work in the place where they live and that they've loved and that their family loved. And so poaching happens around a lot of those communities. When I first started doing research into this, I would be asking investigators and rangers, you know, like, what is the motivation for this? Who is doing it? And they very consistently would say to me, you know, we struggle with poverty here. We're struggling with really high unemployment. You know, linked to that, a lot of folks in these regions are faced with kind of addiction and misuse of drugs and alcohol. And so the motivation is really strong, and also the skill set is really strong. So you have people that have access to the tools to poach a tree. They have the knowledge to know what tree is valuable and where to take it and what it could be turned into. And then the motivation, you know, like the need for money immediately is there. So it kind of all congeals into this region where I did a lot of my reporting. But I actually think that industries around the world probably can see the parallels there, right? Whether it's mining or oil and gas or forestry or even fishing. I mean, these are kind of familiar tales within these industries.
Hmm. Yeah, especially around the idea of a community that for generations has passed down the skills and the tools and the local knowledge of terrain of, you know, which tree is valuable, but also how could you actually get it from the forest to the road without anyone finding out?
Yeah.
And comes up again and again as being important.
Yeah. And it's linked, you know, in that way, it's often really linked to like family relationships, family identity. And like, you know, I was talking to poachers and they would tell me that their dad taught them how to use a chainsaw. Their uncle did. They were around this their whole life. And so I don't think those things I don't think you can separate those details also from the sort of technical part of the poaching itself. Mm. It's all sort of messed up and interlinked together.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it's worth kind of bringing the other side into clearer view as well, right? As you've already mentioned, poaching is not, you know, there's a construction around that, right? Not cutting down every tree is not the same. If you're doing it on protected land, it then becomes mm-hmm. a crime. And so there is kind of the other side to this of the conservation movement, the environmental protection movement. And this, obviously, as I'm sure listeners can realize, there's rather a lot of tension between these two groups. And I was wondering if you could tell us about a particular instance of this, the timber wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, again, much of the book is focused in the Pacific Northwest. And like I was saying, in the 80s and 90s, when the industry was going through like real upheaval, that historically, that has come to be known as the Timber Wars. And so this was a time when there were changes in the Endangered Species Act in North America and in Canada, which it classified the northern spotted owl and the marbled murrelet as endangered species. And what that meant is that any logger or logging company or conservationist who saw a northern spotted owl on a plot of land that they had the rights to log, they were forbidden from logging there anymore. And that really meant that a lot of the work was legally forced to stop, and a lot of people were plunged into sort of precarious work conditions, unemployment. And so there was a lot of, like, first of all, there was a lot of anger directed to this bird, you know, like you would see a lot of times people would have bumper stickers that said "Save a logger, eat an owl," right? You know, so there was a lot of rhetoric and conjecture around that type of thing. And environmentalists had really lobbied for this, for that listing to happen, and so there was also anger at the work that environmentalists were doing to protect these areas. And it kind of erupted, you know, like a whole region was, as the name indicates, at war. So you had people in the forest, like, chaining themselves to trees and to equipment, and then loggers retaliating by, like, throwing axes at them and yelling and threatening their families and threatening their lives. And one of the former loggers told me that his dad, who had run this sort of logging company, had said that he stopped sending out any of his employees that he knew to be hotheads, you know, in quotes, because he knew that the liability was really strong there. And so that, the memory of that is still very, very strong, even though a lot of the people that were working at that point are retired now. You know, maybe their kids wanted to work in the industry but couldn't, and they hold within them the memory of that time and all of the kind of cruelty on both sides that was being hurled at each other. And that there's still a lot of resentment that fuels a lot of anger, you know, and sometimes that anger is against the federal government who runs the national park, for instance, or the federal government who runs the Forest Service, or environmentalists who really, what they were doing was right, but perhaps the way that they were communicating why it needed to be done was just really ineffective and really quite retrogressive in a way.
So that, in addition, of course, to your earlier answers, really helps us understand why this is not a simple solution, right?
No.
Why this is multi-generational, ongoing. Mm-hmm. There are some really clear tensions here, which of course makes the sort of accepted or expected task, I suppose, of the park rangers, of the government in going after crime, in this case, illegally cutting down trees, really hard, I imagine, politically, in addition to the obvious kind of someone's cut down a tree, how the hell do you know what happened next? There's no blood. There's no, you know, it's a difficult crime, I imagine, to deal with as a kind of forensics exercise. But you detail in the book that despite these challenges, there are prosecutions that have taken place for timber theft in these communities. Can you maybe take us through one to illustrate sort of what this looks like and some of the challenges?
Yeah, I mean, it is really quite rare to catch a timber poacher, actually. And so there are a few cases in my book that I follow where they have, but it actually took me quite a while in my reporting process. I had to wait for those cases to come up because it's so unlikely for rangers to find both, like, the crime scene and the crime victim and then the criminal. So anyway, there's one case in particular that I follow that I think really uses all of the sort of interesting tactics that are required to prosecute a timber poacher. And that's the case of Derek Hughes. So he lives in a town called Oreck, which is, we would call it a gateway community. It's right on the edge of Redwoods National Park. And in 2018, you know, Derek Hughes and a companion who remains unnamed were presumed to be stealing from Redwood Burl. And so Burl is a particular sort of timber product. It grows on trees, often in really big bulges, sometimes from the bottom of the tree, sometimes from, you know, upwards. If you've ever seen a tree that has this big knobbly growth, it's bark on the outside, but on the inside it's tree wood. Those are quite valuable. They're often cut off with a chainsaw and they can be sold for artisan crafts, or if they're big enough, like a redwood burl, you can sell them as a table. Derek Hughes was in the woods in the national park, really not very far from the road. And, you know, he stole a burl from Redwood. And, you know, in advance of this theft happening, the Park Service had sort of assumed or had kind of done some work around looking at high profile burls and trees that might be at risk of being poached, and they had hidden some cameras in the trees nearby this burl, actually. So it was a little bit of a lucky situation there. And they caught who they thought was Derek Hughes, the outline of him on camera, bringing in his truck and then loading it up with burl and driving it out. And so even though they had him on, you know, in images doing that, it wasn't quite clear enough that it was him. So they started doing additional work, and they really rely on, you know, local informant networks. For instance, they started asking around other people that they knew in this really small town, you know, who do you think did this? You know, they were often entering into sort of deals with informants, saying, you know, we might make this minor charge that you have go away if you're willing to go on record, you know, giving us information on this. So it really kind of snowballed into a full case where they were, you know, they were applying for a search warrant to enter into Hughes's home, and which they eventually received. And when they went in, they discovered, you know, quite a bit of burl, as well as, you know, they found nearby a camera that they had installed in a tree that had been stolen. And they also found drug paraphernalia and weapons, and, you know, it turned into quite a big case.
Yeah, sounds like it. And of course, yeah. For listeners who want to know more, there's of course more detail about all of these things in the book itself, because it is quite complicated and tricky to piece all these things together. And I was wondering if you could tell us maybe about one of these tools used to try and track these kinds of things down or prosecute them. Because I must admit, in a book about thieving trees, I was not expecting DNA to turn up quite so prominently. So can you tell us about how DNA and sort of related technologies are being used to investigate these kinds of thefts, protect trees?
Yeah. So there's actually two separate research labs, both of them located in the state of Oregon, that that have developed sort of a DNA approach to identifying timber that may have been poached. And part of the reason for that is because if law enforcement, for instance, is tipped off that, you know, a mill has purchased wood that might be illegal, but it's already been milled into planks, it can be really difficult to say, well, we know for sure that that's redwood, and we know for sure that that came from this stump that we've been looking for the wood from. So there was a real need to be able to, you know, use kind of more focused technology to look at the individual tree itself and to be able to try and match it to particular sites. And so actually very recently in the last year, the first tree poaching case that kind of led to a guilty verdict using DNA technology went through the court system. And so the way that the way that that technology works is that, you know, you only need a very bit amount of, or sorry, very small amount of the tree itself. So it can be a shaving from the product. It can even be sawdust found on the floor of a vehicle. And there are a couple ways from there that you can extract DNA from it. But really what both of these, labs are trying to do is create databases so that when wood is seized, or, you know, or even maybe when a poaching site is found, they can take a small sample from that wood, run it through their scientific processes, and apply it to the database to see if there are any matches from previous cases. In one of the databases is actually holds so much DNA up and down the Pacific Northwest. They have teams of people that go out and sample trees over huge swaths of land so that they can identify within 10 kilometers where the sample that's being taken may have originally grown. And that is really big, because it, first of all, it narrows it down to a really quite close sort of land area, I suppose. And you can say, listen, within 10 kilometers, this probably was growing within a national park. This probably was growing in a conservation area. And it makes the risk like really a lot higher, you know, and it makes the risk of being found guilty a lot more imminent.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
it is. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. I don't know how much that's going to deter poachers, because they're still... it's still quite unlikely to actually find the poaching site and to narrow, like, you know, still to even find the site itself and the wood that may have come from the site is, you still need those two elements. But this is now a complicating factor in that crime. So
also scientifically fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting. I mean, one of the labs in Oregon, it's a U.S. Fish and Wildlife lab, but they, you know, they work really with a very broad international scope. And for a while they had an employee that was going around the world to what are called xylaria, which are essentially wood libraries. And often these are collections that were made like in the 18th, 19th century of, you know, explorers going around the world and collecting plant specimens. And they still exist in the back rooms of a lot of museums and botanic gardens. And this employee was taking small shavings from these wood blocks and bringing them back and trying to categorize them so that some of the most highly traded wood in the world could be identified as, you know, using these collections, which is really fascinating. I mean, you have the overlap there of like botanical history with scientific development now with sort of underground criminal networks. It's quite fascinating.
Very much so. But the book, helpfully, I think, doesn't just look at kind of the super high tech side with the particular lab and, you know, park rangers who have to be up for a whole bunch of different kinds of work. You also look at sort of technology that can help more at the community level. So I was wondering if you could tell us about the role of GPS devices and drones.
So I actually learned more about that when I was doing work in Peru than when I was in kind of local or regional forests, which is, I think, quite notable. But there are technologies that we have at our fingertips now that a lot of communities there, which, you know, they really struggle with poaching in much the same way, that they've utilized to do things like alert them to when a poaching activity is taking place. So there's a community in sort of the Amazon region of Peru that was really struggling with poaching through 2018. And what they did was they installed sound-activated GPS devices that would spring to life at the sound at the whir of a chainsaw, basically, and it would alert local wardens that were, you know, maybe they were living in the forest because they were forest wardens, but I mean, they can't have eyes on everywhere all at once. So it would alert them and they would be able to communicate with their local community and their local law enforcement as a way to try and catch the poachers while it was happening, because then you would have the proof of who did it and the tree that was being cut down and where. At the same time, there's another community that, you know, their traditional territory, you know, are often really huge swaths of land. And again, they could only have so much kind of warden presence, ranger presence on that land. And so they were using drones to fly over some of the kind of more remote elements and bring that footage back. And they were, you know, they were seeing within that footage huge areas of their traditional territory and their protected forest being cut down by people that, you know, in some instances were kind of setting up whole camps in the wilderness and building roads to take the wood out. And so that's kind of accessible technology that also means that communities are in charge of monitoring their own land.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really important piece of this, mm-hmm. obviously, as well. So given this, the kind of the challenges that you've outlined for us, but also some of the options that are increasingly available, especially with the Pacific Northwest, where are we at now? Sort of what's the economic state, I suppose? I imagine the pandemic's probably had an impact.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, I think around the world, we were hearing stories about like the cost of building materials going up. And there are a couple of notable cases here where people were like breaking into building supply stores and stealing lots of plywood. So there's that. There's also increased demand for firewood, like I mentioned earlier. So, you know, there's kind of notable reports coming from law enforcement saying that, you know, there's a lot of illegal firewood on the market. The pandemic really sent wood prices on a crazy roller coaster ride. And so there was a real, in British Columbia, where I'm from, there was a real sort of problem there where poaching was on the rise because wood was increasingly in demand and also very expensive. And people were able to kind of maybe mill it into sort of rough materials and sell it, for instance, on Facebook Marketplace for, you know, in their local community pretty quickly. At the same time, we actually also in BC, there were a number of park rangers that were redeployed to work along the border because our border to the United States was closed. And so there were fewer rangers in the forest looking for this crime at the same time. So it was kind of a, you know, a little bit of a double whammy. And there were some community forests even that were reporting at that time that just hundreds of trees were being taken from their land and poached. So.
Not a great state of affairs, but no. Thankfully,
no.
Thankfully, at least I mean, from your book, we're aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's interesting because I think it gives us a glimpse into kind of broader social challenges, right? Mm-hmm. So when I see that, I think, you know, particularly with the firewood, I think it's really notable because the energy crisis is affecting everybody, particularly in Europe. And you might see people poaching wood that otherwise wouldn't have before, but that are relying on wood for their heat now. Or you might see folks capitalizing on that, and maybe they've always known how to chop wood, and they're seeing an opening in the market here. But in any case, you know, it's still fueled by cost of living and poverty and these really big questions that we have of inequality.
In the process of researching this book and obviously writing it, which, as you've already mentioned, kind of involved a lot of digging around and lots of conversations, was there anything in particular that surprised you?
I was surprised at the openness of all the sources, including rangers and poachers and scientists. You know, this was something that in their world was really important that didn't always get attention like they thought it should, particularly because sometimes it can be seen or considered as a just a small property crime, right? If you want to think about old growth trees that way, I mean, that's not untrue. It's just kind of a very straightforward way of looking at it. You know, so I think I was surprised at just how fervently people wanted to talk about this and how they thought that it needed to be written about. I was really thankful for that. And just, I was not surprised at how open the communities that I visited were. You know, I believe that there's a lot of underreporting and underwriting on small rural areas, and people are keen to talk and explain their reality. But I was just really heartened by it. It was very, very reassuring.
Yeah, it's a very nice surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah. Thank you.
especially as researchers, kind of the idea that sometimes people want to talk to you is
And I think, you know, there's always warnings around be careful how you approach people, or be careful that you're not taking advantage of them. I believe that's really important. At the same time, I don't think that should entirely stop us. Like, I think it should guide us, but not stop us, because otherwise you might not, you know, we might be missing a voice, essentially.
Well, I would be interested, and I think our listeners would be, to learn perhaps a little bit more about your voice, if I'm allowed one cheeky final question.
Sure.
This is a little bit mean, because the book has pretty much just come out, but...
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything you've got your eye on next?
Yeah, well, you know, the final chapters of Tree Thieves really digs into community forests and community land management. And I'm hoping that that's where my next project will take me, is kind of looking at community buyout, particularly in Scotland, actually, and the power that that provides to smaller rural communities in sort of ensuring that towns are viable, that people don't have to commit crimes, for instance, where they live, because they are finding local economy there. So I'm really interested in sort of questions of, I could go on and on about this, but I'm really interested in questions of sort of managed degrowth and how local economies might actually play a bit more of a role moving forward, in sort of keeping communities knit together through the environment. And you know, I think part of the lesson of the timber wars is, for instance, that no other industry could effectively replace to the same level what the timber industry was doing. But at the same time, a lot of communities were just left behind. Like, that, you know, there weren't a lot of opportunities for them to, for instance, own a mill or sustainably log from the national park if the national park needs it. And so I'm really interested in how community economics might be a solution to some of these problems.
Okay, well, that sounds very cool. So
yeah, if I don't becomes, know. Thanks.
If that becomes a book, we'll definitely have to have you back to tell us about that. But in the meantime, while you are investigating that, listeners can read the book that we've been discussing, which again is called Tree Thieves, Crime and Survival in North America's Woods, out in 2022 from Little Brown. Lindsay, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.